Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we're going to be talking about in this episode are the top 300 trade sales, including hardcovers, graphic novels, omnibuy, whatever, through Diamond to retailers for February 2017. This is, of course, sell-in information, not sell-through information. So it, of course, includes copies that retailers bought and are still sitting on their shelves, which is the nature of trades. Which is good, because I would be really worried if I went into a comic store and they just had all these empty bookcases. It'd be like, but I can't buy anything, you don't have it. So, it's not uncommon, again, for a little bit of a soft kind of a first quarter or whatnot. I really don't track how the trades go from year to year and stuff too closely, because they've changed the number of items on the list over time. Mm-hmm. And it's just inherently unfair to compare, you know, the top 10 from a decade or so back to the top 300 now. And just doing it for the top 10 seems kind of pointless, too. If we look at the breakdown of the top 300 trades, it's really a roughly even split. I mean, it's not exactly even, but 29.25% of the total units for the top 300 went to Marvel. 27.08% went to DC, 22.11% went to Image, leaving everybody else with, let me total that up real quick, 21.56%. So it's kind of sort of a rough four-way split, favoring obviously Marvel, then DC, then Image, and then everybody else. But this isn't that unusual. Mm-hmm. But that's by units.
Yeah.
We look by dollars, it looks rather different. 55.56% of the total retail dollars, and this is take the number of units for each item, multiply it by the full cover price, total that up, and do the percentages off that. So, again, full retail price, 55.56% went to Marvel, 19.94% to DC, 10.4% to Image, and the remaining 14.1% to everybody else. Mm-hmm. So, while we've got a roughly four-way split, we've got well over half of the dollars going to Marvel, under 20% to DC, a little over 14% to everybody else, with the remaining 10, almost 10.5 going to Image.
Yeah, and if you look at the average price, you can see that Marvel had quite a few pretty expensive items do very well. I think a few of their omnibuy did very well this month.
Yeah, yeah. Because their average price is $55.90 versus DC's $22.73, Image's $14.29. And really, I think Image is smart to do lower-priced introductory items. And Marvel, of course, has Marvel and DC both have a big backlist. But I think Marvel tends to be a little more aggressive with the omnibus and some of the higher price point items than DC is right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've gone through some periods in the past when, like, the Sandman Omnibus or some stuff like that were coming out where DC was a little more aggressive than they are now.
Mm-hmm.
But Marvel also had, you know, 93 items on the list versus the 66 for DC and the 64 for Image.
Yeah, they had about a third more things for sale. Yeah.
When we go through the list, we should keep an eye on the retail ranking, because it's also entirely probable that Marvel did some of the stuff at an aggressive discount. So while they've got the units, because the dollars, again, those high-priced items, so they probably didn't open the discount. If they did, it was on lower-priced items.
Yeah.
But again, we've got, it's a better opportunity, I think, for the smaller publishers on this list than on the comic list. But even so, it's a competitive market.
Mm-hmm. I have been noticing a trend of Dark Horse losing a few percentage shares. And IDW picking up, you know, and I'm not sure if it's the fact that IDW keeps buying imprints like Top Shelf. And so as they fold those into their numbers, you know, their numbers are just going to naturally grow up, or if that's a natural growth for them. I think it obviously is probably a combination of the two, because IDW is a pretty well-run business, but they do every about 6 months seem to buy an imprint.
I think, again, that's one way to grow your business, and not a bad way. But if we look at IDW over time, they've had a steady growth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, made it from kind of the back half into the, I think they were the one that did the jump from the back half to the front half, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And at first it's like, really? But it's totally justified at this point. They're a solid kind of a typically fourth place publisher mm-hmm. behind Marvel and DC, as everyone is going to be behind.
Yeah.
And really not so drastically far behind Image as to, I mean, I think those two are kind of playing in the same sales level. They're not playing at the same rules.
Yeah, absolutely.
IDW is definitely a corporate publisher with licensed properties, not exclusively, but heavily.
I mean, I would say over 90% of their stuff is licensed, but that's still, you know, they're the thing I think has been very smart on IDW's part is, you know, when I got back into comics after a long hiatus, you know, that was about 3 or 4 years ago, you know, they didn't have as much variety, but now, even though they still do a lot of licensing books, there's such variety there. There's everything from superhero books to My Little Pony to books for all ages. You know, there's just such variety in IDW that even though it's like a lot of it is licensing, they have such a wide umbrella that I think that's a really smart.
They seem to be the one publisher that truly understands the concept of diversity in their lineup.
Mm-hmm.
I know Marvel and others are using diversity in terms of the ethnicity and the nature of the characters, which is a perfectly viable and important way to do it too. But to your point, IDW has a very broad range of genres they're representing, of target audiences and age groups they're going after,
mm-hmm.
of license holders they're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is not a situation like it was a decade or so back with Devil's Due that was predominantly licensed properties, but almost exclusively Hasbro properties.
Yeah.
So when they lost Transformers and G.I. Joe, there wasn't much left.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they had other problems that I don't want to go into and stuff that I think, you know, and I'm not saying it was Hasbro leaving them that caused the problems. I think it was, you know, just a lot going on there. But I think IDW, and again, this is in comparison to Dark Horse, while they didn't have an overwhelming percentage of their stuff as licensed, they had Star Wars, and when they lost Star Wars and that went to Marvel, that was a game changer for Dark Horse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not in a crippling kind of a way, but certainly in terms of the amount of volume they do and stuff like that. IDW could probably weather losing any one of their licenses. Or license holders, I should say,
mm-hmm.
Better than Dark Horse was able to kind of weather the storm of Star Wars leaving.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that was such a noticeable percentage of their sales. Certainly Hasbro leaving IDW would be felt, or Star Trek, or whatever, but I really don't think we noticed any kind of a blip in their sales significantly when Doctor Who left.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's going towards having a fairly diverse lineup of titles, and mitigating your risk across several license holders, but also the fact that they're dealing with so many successfully really says something about the way IDW is run.
Yeah, definitely.
So, I mean, I've heard horror stories at times of dealing with licenses, of the notes you get back, you're halfway through a story and they cut it off, or, you know, whatever. There comes a point where if you've garnered enough trust with the license holder, that doesn't happen as often, if mm-hmm. at all.
Yeah.
But you've got to earn that trust. And certainly from a reader perspective, I think IDW has.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the things I'm impressed with them is, you know, out in the, you know, non-direct market, there's still, and I think this is much less than it has been, there's still a stigma with comics and not a lot of people understanding that it's a medium and not necessarily a genre. And I think IDW is one of the companies that understands, and as you can see, they have so many different genres of comics. They understand that it's a form of expression, not necessarily just superheroes. You know what I mean? And a lot of people still struggle with that. I think in the New York Times kind of world, things like that. So it's good when companies kind of stretch the medium, and I like them.
So. No, I agree. It's easy to treat comics incorrectly as a genre, and mm-hmm. it is not. It is a medium. It is a format.
Yeah.
But that's how books are often racked at like a Barnes & Noble kind of a place. Yeah, it's interesting how that I don't, misconception is not the right word, but because I think comics versus prose is a meaningful distinction,
mm-hmm.
but in a different way than genre.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
sell. But I do think we are seeing a steady increase over at IDW, and I think it's a reflection of both how they're running their business and the, again, the decision not to be too reliant on any one thing.
Yep.
So, anything, one other thing before we leave the breakdown. There was some confusion, I think, both on the forum and on the Slack, channel, about breakdown versus, maybe it was just on the forum, breakdown versus, market share. So I wanna address that real quick. I pretty much ignore market share. And the reason for that is the market share is something reported by Diamond, where they take everything they sell, toys, games, comics, books, t-shirts, hats, statues, you name it, and total up the number of units, total up the number of dollars for everybody, and say who had what percent, and say, okay, that's our market share. Okay, that's valuable to somebody, but I'm looking at this from a perspective of how are comics doing, how are our trades doing, and having a market share that is influenced by, say, Marvel or DC having more toys than, say, a Titan Comics or an Oni Press. Mm-hmm. Or somebody having a lot of expensive statues or the Eagle Moss figures and ships and whatnot. All of that factors into the market share. And it's, in my mind, kind of irrelevant to the question at hand as to how are comics, how are trades selling, what are the trends there, and what are we likely to see in the future because of this, and what lessons can we learn from the past? And because I don't have all of the data that's used to make up the market share, I can't kind of recreate that and say, yeah, I get how it's calculated. The breakdown of the top 300, I've got the top 300, both of the comics and the trades. I can calculate that. So when somebody says, oh, was this included? It's like, well, yeah. I can answer the question. Two, I can do it authoritatively. And three, I could tell them what it would look like without that if they wanted it out or whatever. Because there was some question on the comic side this month about the 25-cent promotional priced issue of Walking Dead. Mm-hmm. And was that included in the market share, which I presume it was. Was that included in the breakdown of the top 300? Which it was not, because it was not on the top 300. So it if you're going to compare numbers, which of course is the whole point of having numbers, is to give you something empirical you can compare, make sure the numbers you're comparing are measuring the same sort of thing. And it can easily get confusing at times, no two ways about that. So I just kind of wanted to clarify, and this had come up a decade or so back when I was first starting to report on the numbers and stuff, what the difference is between the market share and the breakdown.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Shall we jump over to the list?
Sounds good.
All right, this time I don't want to start at the top of the list. I want to start with items 25 and 125 on the list. We're gonna talk about Batman Volume 1 trade paperback, because we talked about that, gosh, it seems like so long ago. It was literally only 2 weeks ago we had that discussion. And what had happened, for those who didn't listen to the last trades episode, is I'm sitting here looking at the numbers and I'm saying, okay, Batman Volume 1, I Am Gotham. First time it sold, it did, what did it do? 9,122 units last month. Followed by me, I think, saying, and then it's gotten a total reported sales of 101,673 items for an item that was just released and had only sold 9,122 items.
Yeah. Outstanding sales.
Yeah. Unbelievable sales. Who would believe it? And of course it was wrong. Which we had immediately recognized and whatnot. And the confusion had come in with my system on how I have to handle trade sales. Now, one would think all I'm taking is just, here's some data from Diamond. I'm taking the index value, multiplying it by something to get the number of units. It's just added up. How hard could it be? Well, the first volume of a trade, particularly if it's not obvious, there will be a second volume. Say the start of a small, you know, mid to low selling a comic over from a creator-owned property or something, selling, you know, 6,000-7,000 units. I mean, who knows if it's going to last long enough to get a second volume. So they'll just have name of it as, boom, it's out there, it's volume one. Now, once it gets a second volume, they'll go back to the, when they list that first volume again on the sales, mm-hmm. They'll put the subtitle there, volume one, whatever. So in some cases, there's never the second volume, so it never really matters. But if you look at something like, The Walking Dead, mm-hmm. The first volume, when it was first listed on the trade charts, didn't have the subtitle. They added it later. So if I include the subtitle as part of what distinguishes volumes, suddenly I have two Volume 1 trade paperbacks for The Walking Dead with and without the subtitle. And that's not right. So I was excluding the subtitle, which would have differentiated Batman Volume 1 I Am Gotham from Batman Volume 1 The Court of Owls. Mm-hmm. So since I can't do that, what I've wound up doing, and it took me a little bit to figure this out since we talked last, we had talked about if the ISBN would be useful. It indeed is, because they obviously have different ISBN numbers. That allowed me to very easily distinguish Batman Volume 1 I Am Gotham from Batman Volume 1 Court of Owls, regardless of if the I Am Gotham or the Court of Owls is listed in the entry, if it's Batman Volume 1 trade paperback. Because they have the different ISBNs, I can now differentiate them. Great! Solves the problem, right? No. Because the other thing I've got on these Excel files we're looking at, and once I get them to where I'm happy and they're a little easier to update, I may even release them to the public. I may not, but I might. But we've got estimated sales, the total reported sales. Okay, I can now differentiate those. Then we have previous volume number and previous volume total reported estimated sales. So what that means, for volume one, it means nothing. For volume two of something, now I need to be able to go and get that squared away. And I do that on new items. I don't bother with that on the reorder items, just because I don't. Maybe I should, don't know. But what that means is when I've got a volume two, I need to correctly find the right volume one. Okay, I can differentiate the two volume ones, but which volume one goes to, say, Batman Volume 2, The City of Owls?
Mm-hmm.
Now, looking at it, we would think, well, of course, it's the Court of Owls. We just know that. Computers don't just know things. So there's nothing on the top trades list that would allow me to correctly associate those things.
Gotcha.
Fortunately, there's other data I can put into the mix to do that. Because not only do I need it for the previous volume and previous volume sales, if you go all the way over to column AC, I've got the collected edition history. And for Batman Volume 1, I Am Gotham, I only want that. But for the other one, I want all 9 volumes of that previous run.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, I can get them using the Diamond Series code, which they assign to anything that's kind of expected to have another volume and such. Now, I haven't done enough due diligence to know how reliable that series code is, but it seems to be good enough to be better than what I had before, which was just wrong. So I've been able to kind of get that squared away, which is good because, of course, we've gotten a few other Rebirth volumes, and no doubt this has been plaguing things like the seasonal model over at Marvel, where they continually have everything be a Volume 1 and reuse titles left, right, and center.
That makes sense, yeah.
Part of this, though, is the terminology gets a little confusing and meaningless. What is a volume of a trade paperback? Well, the volume number is essentially equivalent to the issue number. What's a volume of a comic book series? Well, it's the run. We've got the new 52 volume of Batman. We've got the Rebirth volume of Batman. We've got the original volume of Batman. And if you're using volume as issue number on the trade side, what's the equivalent of a volume of volumes? So it's just, that's part of why I kind of go with title runs for the terminology I use in my system for, again, the new 52 run or the Rebirth run or the original run or anytime they renumber it, it's a new title run.
That makes sense.
Yeah, because the whole voluming thing is...
So then here's a quick question for you. So, and this obviously will be probably easier to answer on the comic issue side. So Action Comics and Detective Comics are going back to their 900 numbers, assuming the honest truth is because they, when they get to 1,000, they want to sell expensive versions of that, I'm sure. But in terms of voluming, it's technically volume. Is it going back to volume 1 of Detective Comics renumbered, or is it volume 3 of Detective Comics? Because there's the one that was from 1940s, the new 52, and then this new one, or is it back to volume 1?
I do not believe there is an authoritatively correct answer to that.
Okay.
Typically what is done in places like Overstreet, Comic Book DB, and other places is they use the first volume again.
Okay.
It picks back up. And that's what I do as well.
Now, here's a question. And you may have explained this 2 times ago, but I guess I'm a little hazy on it. So let's say the original Detective Comics ended on issue 930. Then they did 50 issues in the new 52. When they start in the 900s again, is it 990? Or is it 941? Do you know what I mean? Like, do they treat it as like they just add them back in? Or do they treat them as if they're separate?
Typically, they add them back in.
Okay.
But there's nothing to say that they have to.
Okay.
Now, if you go over at Marvel, who has done this many, many, many times before, there are really three options, I think. One, pick up where you left off. They have done that.
Mm-hmm.
Journey into Mystery became Thor. Thor later became Journey into Mystery, later became Thor kind of a thing. there are cases where it's just Amazing Fantasy. They've actually done it, ended at 15. They've done a 16, 17, and 18 decades later.
Mm-hmm.
There's take the number of issues you sold or you released under the other title and increment by that much and then pick up after that.
Okay.
Fantastic Four is a good example of this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It ended at, 583 or whatever it ended at. It went for about a dozen issues under FF or Future Forum, and then it came back under the old numbering.
Okay.
Then there's what they did on Daredevil, among others, where they do both numbering concurrently.
Oh.
So, cause that's not confusing. And you're looking, they did this also on Fantastic Four at one point. I think it was during the Wade run where it was issue 70 of one volume and 5-something of the other volume simultaneously.
Oh boy. Did it say that on the cover?
Yes.
Oh god.
So, if there is some way for them to make things even more confusing, they usually, I'm not saying they do it intentionally. But they have an amazing knack over the decades to find these things. Now, obviously, when those things hit the solicitation, the sales, the shipping lists, Diamond has been sane and only used one of them, I think, in most cases.
Gotcha.
Fortunately, I think the dual numbering in Daredevil's case, it may predate the sales data I've got for the final order era. I'd have to go digging. But it certainly confuses the matter.
Yeah.
Again, to your question around Detective and other things that revert to the previous volume numbering, when they do that, I treat it as if the later volume has ended and the previous one has recontinued after a hiatus.
Okay.
But I want to find some good software, and I'm sure comics tend to overlap with, I think, technical people.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm willing to bet we've got some software engineers listening to this podcast. So they're probably going to understand what I'm going to explain a little better than maybe everybody. When you write software and you use source control systems to say this is the authoritative copy, you can branch the copy saying I'm going to make a change, have it reviewed, and then kind of merged back into the official copy, the master branch, if you will. Things like Git, Subversion, and other programs like that that do source control have this kind of branching timeline and whatnot and can fold things back in. I want something where I can do those sorts of diagrams and say, okay, here's Fantastic Four 1 through whatever. At this point, it branches and becomes Future Forum and then reverts back to the first volume and picks up where it left off.
Mm-hmm.
Or runs in parallel in those cases of the dual numbering I talked about. Or in the case of, let's go back to the 80s when New Teen Titans hit a point where it sort of stopped and two titles came out of it for a year. One of which was a new volume of New Teen Titans on nicer paper. The other was Tales of the New Teen Titan that used the numbering of the previous Teen Titans and went for a year concurrently and then became a reprint series of the other one.
Oh, lordy.
So finding a way to diagram that.
Wow.
That I can drop into an article or something would be nice. Because then you hit something like the case of the Spider-Man titles where you've got Spider-Man that becomes Spider-Man, Peter Parker, Spectacular Spider-Man. I mean, I am reasonably confident, but I haven't been able to diagram this out, so I'm not positive, that there have been two Spider-Man titles that over the course of a decade or so flipped titles with other things in between.
Oh, jeez.
And I know Spectacular there's Spectacular Spider-Man, there's Spectacular Spider-Man, Peter Parker, there's Peter Parker, Spectacular Spider-Man, and sometimes it's just they're renaming it, sometimes they're actually different names. Or different volumes, or different title runs, or whatever you want to call these things. It's just like we've got an Invincible Iron Man that's not the previous Invincible Iron Man series, and that Invincible Iron Man, had been something else, it's...
Yeah, the Superior Iron Man, yada yada.
Just tracking those title changes.
Yeah.
And part of why I want to do that is, one, to illustrate how confusing this can get, but two, that's how I can vet out these series codes I'm using to group these trade paperback collections, because if they don't give it a new series code when they, you know, let's use Detective as an example. If they revert to the old numbering and give it the same series code as the previous run of Detective Trades, yet the Detective new set starts at volume one again, I'm back in this situation where I may double count.
Yeah.
And part of it is there is no consistency, there is no convention, there is no you must do it this way for naming, for numbering, and any of that stuff. Anything goes.
They usually do what's convenient for them.
Whatever makes sense at the time.
Yeah.
You know, and there have actually been times where they've misnumbered something because they simply lost track of which annual they were on.
Which is pretty funny, actually.
Oh, you laugh. I'm willing to bet you could go through the various comic book podcasts out there, hopefully not including my own, and find ones that have either skipped an episode number or doubled up on one.
Oh,
it's easy to do.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree, and I'll give you another example. There are a number of blogs in the trades world that are dedicated to, you know, so there's one that just reviews like DC trades, and there's probably one that focuses on Marvel. And they always do previews because every couple months, Marvel, DC, people will troll Amazon, or they'll get the book distributor catalogs, which are like 6 months out, and they have mm-hmm. all the trades that are coming out. And this is why this is the love hate we have with comics readers. So the solicit for the collected edition of some, you know, past run that had a lot of crossovers, the people on these forums will go through them and then send emails to the editors at Marvel or DC saying, oh, you forgot this, issue because that was part of this crossover, or that was part of the story, or you forgot this, or why is this not included? Why do you have to try and make the, you know, it's so funny. And that half of the comments on the articles are, oh, we better start sending them emails now so they can actually put the right stuff in the book.
And it's funny because from the editor's perspective on the comics, they haven't announced it to the comic realm.
Nope. Yeah.
So they're like, we haven't even announced it and you're already complaining.
Yeah. Well, but you know, and I would say, yeah, 75% of the time it's just complaining. Every once in a while, though, they will actually get something that was wrong corrected. And like, you know, cause some of these editors, maybe they're 30, they haven't been around the whole time, and they certainly didn't necessarily read the runs from the 60s and 70s, you know? So some of that stuff for these guys that actually originally collected it and just loved those series, and they can, from memories, you know, tell you what numbers of issues were in this run. You know, they actually have helped correct a few, you know, either the solicit was just the solicit was wrong, but also, you know, I've seen conversations in, forums about, you know, having email chains with the actual editors at Marvel DC and saying, oh yeah, we did forget that one. We'll make sure that one actually gets in the print version. So.
Yeah, a lot of those editors want to do the right thing. And like you said, they may not have read all of it. And to give credit where credit is due, I may give Tom Brevoort a little bit of a hard time at times for some of the decisions he's made or some of the comments he's made, etc. But man, the guy is a hardcore comic book fan, mm-hmm. incredibly knowledgeable about the past stuff, and a little bit of a rare breed, I think, in terms of comic editors that, cause I had seen him on, what panel was it? It must have been C2E2 last year on the trivia panel, maybe, where he was subbing for somebody on the fan side because one of their members had passed away not too long before. And it was those four guys up against Mark Waid. Waid won, of course, because he's, I think, in a class in and of himself in terms of geekdom. But yeah, some of these guys, they know this stuff inside and out. Most editors, frankly, they don't.
Mm-hmm.
They may be better editors technically. They may be a better editor for this day and age, even. They may not be. But the kinds of editors that are fans, I don't say first or even predominantly, but you know what I mean, hardcore yeah. fans.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number I could name. Waid certainly would have been one of them when he was an editor and stuff at the various times. Brevoort, absolutely, and I respect them both a lot in that regard. One of them I would say was somebody that I wish I was enough older that I could have experienced his full tenure as editor and stuff is Mark Grunewald.
Mm-hmm.
Because I recall chatting with him, standing around after a panel or whatever around the time of the Marvel Handbook and stuff, And he was getting badgered by a bunch of people. What about this? What about this? And the guy could hold his own. I mean, he knew this stuff inside and out. And that was part of why we have things like the official handbook of the Marvel Universe and stuff. He was a hardcore comic book fan as well as just a really good editor, storyteller, etc. Mm-hmm. But I think the day and age where the editors were predominantly of that type and the day and age we're in now where, frankly, I'm not sure where they're finding these editors. And I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. Maybe they're getting them out of colleges of people who, I don't know exactly what you would study to be an editor, but, you know, maybe they're finding them that way. I don't get the sense that the average editor on the average comic book knows the backstory of these characters inside and out and could tell you almost off the cuff all the tie-ins of a given event or whatever from a decade back.
And you know what? That brings up a good point, is that as corporate as Marvel has become, maybe that's not the skill set that they hire for anymore. They hire for making sure these books get out on time, generate the ability to generate ideas that will lead to potential outbreak books like Ms. Marvel, and keeping the trains running, you know, and in the double shipping era and the variant era, you know, maybe the skill set that Marvel managers are prioritizing, I'm not saying it's the correct one, I'm saying just the one they're prioritizing, is not necessarily the one that has continuity. Now, there have been a lot of rumblings about Marvel and DC not, you know, one of the reasons DC has found success again was acknowledging its heritage and going back to, you know, continuity and Rebirth being successful because more readers recognize the characters, you know, from the previous runs. But maybe that's not what Marvel is valuing right now. Maybe they're valuing maximizing their IP and push, you know, I don't know.
Well, and certainly I think, Sama Aminat, the editor who's pivotal in getting the Ms. Marvel character, Kamala Khan, created and out there. Editors like that are absolutely needed, incredibly valuable, and she's in particular doing an awesome job.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's necessarily an either or kind of a situation. I think you need to have an editorial team. Granted, certain editors are going to be assigned certain books, but you need on that team people that are looking after the, hey, not everybody is represented and not everybody has a character they can truly connect with.
Mm-hmm.
Gotta have that. And that's one of the things I think, among other things, Aminat is really added to the Marvel Universe. We've gotten a lot of really strong female characters as a result of her influence. I think you also need people of the ilk of Brevoort and Wade's that have that backstory, that know what's going on before, that could be used as resources for the other editors. No, you're telling a story that we've already told before. So let's make sure it's either different, better, or more relevant or whatever. And something to where you've got the advantage of the history, the continuity, and can leverage that and not be held captive by it either.
Mm-hmm.
But then you also need some people on that editorial team that frankly are just amazing at spotting typos, grammatical errors, production goofs, and on the nuts and bolts mechanics of things, catch a lot of things, even if they may not be that good at overall story direction or diversifying the lineup of characters or knowing the backstory or whatever. There's a whole mix of different skill sets you need to have a really well-rounded editorial team, and I don't think finding that is easy.
Yeah. Oh, I completely agree. I just think that the honest truth, John, is I think that is a little bit of an idealized version of what you want. What I think the reality of today in Marvel and DC is they are oriented to pushing product out the door and the people that are most efficient at doing that, because you can't honestly tell me that there are a lot of people left at Marvel that care about continuity. How many times they reboot everything, I don't believe they care about continuity. Now, there may be people on the masthead that have a history of caring about continuity, but what Marvel's actions show is that they would rather double ship everything for $3.99 or $4.99, and that's the most important thing. And as long as it sells, I don't, you know, one of the things I think DC realized is the New 52, you know, the success of it, the beginning was fine, but then it petered out. And when things aren't working, yes, they may be willing to go back to creative wells, like when Marvel was in trouble with the Marvel Knights thing and like that. But I just don't know in my opinion, I think they value efficiency and getting books out the door more than those other things. And I wish it wasn't true, but I just think that that's what Marvel does.
I don't disagree with you at all. I agree entirely. to that point when on when I was writing my article, I was looking for a Marvel title that was in that suspended category of just, it had sales that it could, if they could have just gotten them out in February, would have actually made a difference. Mm-hmm. And given them an edge over DC for the month. Mm-hmm. Not that that really matters, but it was hard to find such a title.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing I just thought of is maybe it's actually always been that way at the Big Two about making sure the product gets out the door. But the fact is that in the past, they didn't publish nearly as many titles. So it was easier for editors to wrangle continuity, and because there just were flat out less books to worry about. You didn't, you know, and during certain eras, yeah, you did, like, there were like 6 or 7 Spider-Man books at once. So yeah, maybe in a select corner of the universe, it was a lot to wrangle. But nowadays, you know, one of the things we talk about all the time in the individual issues is that some of the companies use volume of number of titles to crowd out other publishers so they don't get rack space as a weapon to actually, you know, be successful. So some of Marvel's publishing strategy is to literally flood out the other publisher's space on the wall. You know what I mean? So now there's just so many titles from both DC and Marvel that, you know, the continuity thing may be just be hard to do that with the number that they're producing.
Yes and no. There's an aspect of, because they're producing so much, they can't keep track of all of it for all time. I get that. I'm not expecting them to. Mm-hmm. But having a miniseries with Bullseye, who's in a very public, well, geez, that's where he is. He's causing a lot of carnage. Concurrent with a Daredevil story where he's having to get Bullseye out of hiding.
Yeah, published at the same time. Yeah, that is a little problem.
So, and to your point, having people who can traffic the books and get the trains running on time in terms of, I mean, it does it get to the printer? Does this have, you know, just the process side of it, that's an important skill set too. And I think they're focusing certainly on that, as they should, because if they don't, they don't get the books out, they don't get the money, they don't get paid. You gotta get the product out. But, I mean, to me, this is what I would want out of an editorial team. Is that what they have? No, I don't think so. But I think when you start to say, and continuity is a very misunderstood thing. You look at this list of trades and hardcovers and whatnot we've got, and there are things that go back, you know, decades in terms of the material being collected. So there is a desire by the readers to have that backstory, that history, the what's going on. I think editors should be aware of it, should play into it, but not be held captive by it. If you're ever at a story and the story hinges on what color socks somebody wore 3 decades ago, you're telling the wrong story.
Yeah.
You know, there are times where with continuity, as the story gets further and further back, unless it is a pivotal story, an origin, a major, oh my God, turning point sort of a thing that everyone will always remember, you can fudge the details. Mm-hmm. You can downplay the details. You can kind of ignore the details. But when you start going in blatant violation of some of these things, and this is where I think DC and Marvel have both kind of gone wrong, more so at DC, actually. What is the origin of Supergirl? It's like, well, which Supergirl first? And at what point are you talking? Because the origin differs, you know? And it's like, how hard should this be? It's like, yeah, if you had a clean continuity, it wouldn't be hard. She was rocketed to Earth, Superman found her, yada yada, boom, done. Gloss over any inconvenient details, you know, decades later. But they've had her rocket to Earth a couple of times. And it gets confusing, it muddies the water. So having editors that don't care about past continuity is bad enough. Those that don't care about current continuity and the potential corner they're painting themselves into with some of the stories is even worse. Because every time you kill off a character, if you don't have a built-in reversion clause, if you will. I mean, Wolverine died. He's going to come back as we knew him at some point. He's too good of a character not to. All new Wolverine, Old Man Logan, notwithstanding, sooner or later, we're going to have quote-unquote, the real Wolverine back. Likewise, Thor is going to get back to where it's the Odin son. They're going to get back to whatever the basics are, if you will, and I have that in air quotes that you can't see, because it's comic storytelling alternates between the bold, the new, and the back to basics approaches. Mm-hmm. And there's validity on both sides, but if you've gotten it to where once you've told a story, there's no going back, that's just naive. Somebody down the line will want to go back. They will go back. And if you've got in out or whatever, that's that works. But I think this is something that is a lesson DC has learned that led to Rebirth. You throw the baby out with the bathwater in terms of the continuity and the backstory. Readers rebel. This isn't my Superman. Oh, well, we'll give you back your Superman. Is that better? You know, and I think Marvel, having never done a full out and out reboot, has avoided this problem. But their continuity has also gotten kind of lax, kind of confusing. And when it gets to the point where if you were to do a write-up, a Marvel Universe entry write-up kind of a thing, and you're just kind of thinking through your head, provided you know the backstory and can do this, what would be kind of the equivalent of newspaper headlines for this character in their life? Dying, coming back from death, dying again, coming back from death, new costume, new name, joining a team, leaving a team, you know, things of that nature. And when it gets to where you can literally see the pendulum swinging back and forth as you go down this list or whatever, or you go through so many things that seem like they absolutely have to matter that none of it matters, or just trying to explain the backstory of a character to somebody who's seen the character on a Netflix show, a TV show, a movie, whatever, you go into a half hour, you know, a PhD level exercise in comic book history, you've done something wrong. And again, you look at this list and you see a number of things that are the new continuity, the old continuity, and every once in a while something whose sole purpose seemed to be to clean up continuity.
Yeah.
I think really the best example of forward-thinking continuity was when the decision at DC was made to tell Watchmen with a new set of characters versus reusing the original set the characters were based on. Because it allowed them to then use Blue Beetle and these other characters as Blue Beetle and these other characters elsewhere, ongoing. Versus if they had done, instead of having, Night Owl, Dr. Manhattan, and Rorschach, if that had been the question, or had been Blue Beetle, Captain Atom and the question respectively, think of all the other titles we would not have gotten as a result.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because it paints those characters into a permanent corner. So that was a long digression on continuity and whatnot, but
no, but I think it's, you know, it's just part of the convoluted aspect of the of superhero comics that's interesting. You know, sometimes comics fans are their own worst enemies. You know, I listened to another comics podcast recently, and they just can't get over the changes to Superman's costume, and I just that thing is the costumes and things like that. Like, I on one level I understand it, but on another it boggles my mind that they literally let that determine how they feel about the story. I'm like, if the story is good, I honestly, as long as he's wearing clothes, I could care less what Superman is. And I get that it's an iconic outfit, and I get it, but I don't know. Like, you know, I always thought the best Spider-Man costume was the 2099 Spider-Man. So, and you know, that's like a fringe character. So, you know, everyone's got their you know, but I don't not read Spider-Man costumes because they don't put the main guy in this 2099 costume. You know, so.
Immediately before San Diego Comic-Con back in 2011, I sat down with John Rood and Bob Wayne, and they wanted to talk about, you know, the upcoming New 52 and stuff. Mm-hmm. And Bob Wayne made a comment about how, and I'd have to go back and double-check the exact nature of the comment, but it was around how there are some fans that, you know, man, the minute Clark Kent was working for the Daily Planet versus the Daily Star, oh, it was ruined. Oh, the minute they put that damn yellow oval behind the bat on Batman, it was ruined. You know, kind of, and he wasn't quite that extreme. Yeah. Although he did mention both of those specific examples. I just forget exactly the context he was using. And
well, I'm sure they get mail. They get mail and email like that all the time.
Well, he was trying to, I believe, equate the New 52 as it will be different, but not so different it ruins the characters. In other words, I think downplaying the reboot aspect significantly and incorrectly so, perhaps. Again, I'd have to go look up what his exact comments were. But it comes down to Batman's costume now has the yellow outline around the bat. Okay, it's a change. Superman's costume is different. Do I like it? Not as much as the classic, but I'm old school. Is that enough to ruin the character? Oh, come on. You know, if the team uniform prevents you from enjoying a good football game, maybe you're not watching for the right reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And certainly it's not that it's invisible to me and not an impact. There are times where it's like, yeah, it's hard to get used to this new look or whatever. And there are times where sometimes the change they make actually undercuts significant core aspects of the character, and I think that's bad.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, continuity matters, not because of, it's history, it's whatever, but it either gets somebody, entrenched and engaged with the property, or it doesn't. If Walking Dead did not have the sense of an ongoing storyline, an ongoing history, that we're following Rick Grimes and these other characters through their trials and tribulations in this zombie infested world, if we weren't invested in that, if we felt that there was, it just doesn't matter, he's going to reboot it, who cares, the first volume would not have racked up over 400,000 units in trade sales just for the trade paperback, just through the direct market. It would not be what it is.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, if there was not some sense that Batman the Killing Joke mattered, it would not be closing in on a 250,000 units of sales. You know, there's an aspect of if you disregard continuity to the point of, this just doesn't matter, nobody's going to care in 6 months, the sales reflect that.
Yeah.
And that's part of where I have concerns about Marvel's, they call it a seasonal model. I think that's not the right term. Revolving door comes to mind. perhaps it's not particularly kind or charitable.
I was just going to say, I don't think that that would go well in their promo material.
But it feels accurate.
Oh, there's a lot of things that feel accurate about Marvel. Like, there's a lot of ways that I would talk about Marvel's pricing and their shipping practices and how many pages of story you get per book and things like that. But they wouldn't want that in their PR material.
That is true. Speaking of pricing, I do want to address one of the things that we talked a little earlier about, how they may have potentially discounted a few things. Maybe they didn't on others. If you look at Rank 19, the Rawhide Kid Volume 1 Masterwork reorder activity, it's a $24.99 cover price. The item right below it has a $9.99 cover price. Mm-hmm. But Rawhide Kid Volume 1 had a retail rank of 186. That item, that's what, 2.5 times less or whatever, or this is 2.5 times more than, I should say, is at rank 97 for the retail rank, implying that Marvel Masterwork was significantly discounted.
If you go down just one more item, if there's the same priced item, $24.99.
That's a much better comparison, you're right. Yeah,
and it's retail rank 23, so that is quite a bit of discounting.
Yeah.
Normal item. Yeah. Which makes sense. You know, there is a very limited, in my opinion, a limited market for the Marvel Masterworks. Now, the paperbacks are a little bit different in that they're much more reasonably priced, but I believe the Marvel Masterwork hardcovers are up to $75 a piece now, aren't they?
I've lost track, to be honest, because I stopped getting them quite some time ago.
Yeah. No, I never got them, but I always thought they were a nice product. But I noticed how, and this is kind of that trap you get into when you're selling the same thing to a smaller and smaller base, you kind of have to raise the price. And yeah, you try to make it a prestige product so that it quote unquote feels worth it. But I remember seeing in the previews when these things were like $49.99, then they were like $60. And now I think the mainline ones, you know, like X-Men, Fantastic Four, those ones are like $75.
Well, when you said there was a limited audience for this and then went Marvel Masterwork, I was expecting you to go Rawhide Kid.
Well, yeah, that's a minuscule, inside minuscule, but I meant more of like the Marvel Masterworks. Cause you know, in a lot of ways, the most popular stuff has already been published. Yes, they're still putting out, parts of that collection for the runs that are, you know, 600 issues long for X-Men, Fantastic Four, things like that, Spider-Man. But now that they're kind of working their way through like a lot of the more obscure titles, yeah, absolutely. This would probably be a pretty hard sell.
I mean, Rawhide Kid, it's a Western, not a superhero thing. If it was Two Gun Kid, I would at least say that would have had a little more relevance, because that character at least, and I don't know how, but somehow managed to take the state of Montana for the U.S. Avengers cover gimmick.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there are a couple of these things that if you've still got copies sitting in a warehouse, discounting them and getting them out the door is not a bad plan.
Yeah. Well, and if you actually look at the total numbers sold and then the numbers sold this month, they literally looks like the previous time it was solicited, they sold basically about 700, less than 700, and at probably the full, you know, retail obviously minus discount. And now in order to move them, you know, these 2,100 units, they had to really discount it. I'm almost wondering if this is the rest of the print run.
I'm thinking it is.
Yeah.
And I would, based on the numbers you're seeing, estimate they did a print run probably maybe of around 3,000.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
And then, like you said, only sold, what, around 600, 700?
Yeah, exactly.
That's, again, long tail. You expect it to sell over time, and if you're wrong, you're wrong.
Yeah.
And it looks like they may have been. Again, not knowing what exactly the print run was, but obviously it was well above what they initially sold.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't go into another print run and then do it on a fire sale. That's just bad business. One of the other things, though, I do want to point out from Marvel is down at rank 52, it was the third item retail rank-wise, Alpha Flight by John Byrne Omnibus hardcover.
Yeah, that sold very well for an omnibus. That's a really good showing.
$100, it did 1,502 units. This collects, I'm imagining, let me double check, I'm going to say the first 24 issues. Oh, wow. It collects a lot more than I thought.
Well, it's the omnibus. It's huge. It's like 1,200 pages. So.
All right, this has X-Men 109, 220 and 221, and 139 and 140, so some of their original appearances there. Machine Man, number 18, Marvel 2-in-1, 83 and 4, Incredible Hulk, 272, 313, and annual number 8, Alpha Flight 1 through 29, X-Men and Alpha Flight 1 and 2, X-Men Alpha Flight 1 and 2, because there were two volumes over different years, and then some material from the Marvel Team-Up annual number 7, which they showed up in peripherally because Sasquatch was involved. When I think John Byrne Alpha Flight, I think the first 24 issues of Alpha Flight. Mm-hmm. This is way more material.
Mm-hmm.
But just those first 24 issues of Alpha Flight were amazing. And then to get pretty much every other appearance they seem to have made, during that time frame, that's a hell of a collection.
Yeah. You know, when this was solicited, I was kind of excited because if they're willing to do these, then maybe they're going to be willing to do an Excalibur omnibus. And that's what I'm looking forward to. Cause when I was originally in comics, that was one of my favorite series. So we'll see.
Are they doing an Alpha Flight Epic collection?
You know what? It's funny you say that. I have not seen an Alpha Flight one, but I have seen the Excalibur one. So maybe they may not do the Excalibur omnibus. They may just do the Epic collection. So, you know, it's kind of I always hold my heart is always in the omnibus section. But like for things that I can't get my hands on, I will take the Epic collection. Funnily enough, they just resolicited one of the grails of the omnibus I haven't gotten is the Punisher run by Ennis in the omnibus form has been out of print for a long time, and it's so expensive on the out of print market. It's like $200. So they finally are going to reprint that. So I'm excited. So certain things get reprinted, certain things don't. Then they switch formats. You know, it's in the collected edition game. It's a lot of like looking around corners, hoping.
Yeah. I was editing the latest preview spotlight yesterday as we record this, and there were some clips for that Punisher omnibus.
Oh yeah, well, that's a big excitement that's getting republished.
What tends to be the average price point on one of those Epic collections, though?
So this is interesting. I think I talked to you about this a little bit before. So if it's an Epic collection that's going to have multiple volumes, they always try to and it's a relatively mainline series, they'll always try and publish that for, and it's usually between 350 pages and 450 pages for $34.99. And then the back end of the series, like volume 3-4 of the Epics, they'll usually try to because they know they've gotten people to get the first couple. Those are always $39.99. The Epic collections max out at $39.99, and they're always paperbacks. So.
But they're about a third the size of an omnibus.
Generally, yeah. So Marvel omnibuses range from about 800 pages to about 1,250 pages is about the max. And that's probably about the reason that's the max is because the binding starts to become an issue at a higher page count. And you also have to make some compromises on, you know, just the weight and everything in terms of shipping and all that stuff. So yeah, the omnibus is going to be anywhere from about 800 pages. Now, Marvel, in their infinite corporate wisdom of extracting as much money as possible, will do special omnibuses for things like Hawkeye, which are about 350 to 400 pages, or the New Avengers by the McKelvey and,
The Gill and McKelvey,
right? Yeah, exactly. New Avengers, that are a little bit smaller. And I actually don't begrudge certain ones because they're kind of really nice runs, but other ones, they're still asking $75 to $100 for like 300 or 400 pages, which I think is a little outrageous. But once you get into the 800 plus pages range, I don't mind paying a little bit more. And obviously, I always get the 50% off, so.
I always worry about the weight of these thousand-page tomes.
Yes.
Afraid, you know, I'm going to go to reach to pick it up off the bookshelf or the coffee table, and wrist will just snap off because of the weight.
Well, that's why I always sit in a good stable chair or have it sitting on a desk as I read them.
Small little forklift nearby.
Yeah, no, and don't get me wrong. Sometimes when I get out my Sandman absolutes and I have to read them, I'm like, ooh, maybe the hardcover, you know, single individual volumes would have been a better choice. But I do like them as an artifact, and Sandman's one of my favorite stories, and I pretty much reread that at least once a year. So it's like, you know, I definitely get value out of that. You know what I mean? Like,
I'm wondering if I have a source where I could add the dimensions to this list. Because your mention of the absolute, one of the things I love about, like, the JLA Avengers, you know, that wasn't technically an absolute because of cross company, but Crisis Absolute and those things is the oversized nature of them. It's like the artist edition and stuff. You've got just such a bigger page that there's more room to really kind of absorb the art and whatnot. And for some artists, George Perez, you know, John Byrne, they've got such a clean line style and a sense of detail at times, certainly with Perez at almost all times, that having that larger page is just, it's so nice.
And maybe contrast that with an oversized Frank Miller. Maybe not.
Maybe not.
Yeah, it depends, right? Like, you see more of the scratches on the...
Well, I was going to say the other juxtaposition to do would be a... Dark Horse would call an omnibus, which is essentially a digest. Mm-hmm. And it's, what, a 6x9 kind of thing, so it's even smaller than normal. Mm-hmm. Or I forget the dimensions, but yeah. Because I do think the dimensions play in, and I'm curious how many different, quote-unquote, standard sizes there are.
Oh, there are a lot. I'm looking at my bookshelf right now, and there are quite, you know, it's definitely not even almost anywhere, so... All kinds of sizes.
Well, and we've had this discussion before over the years and stuff. I mean, you go to a bookstore, you look at the graphic novel section for American comics, if you will, mm-hmm. and you've got that complete inconsistency. No two things seem to be the same size, much less two things next to each other. Then you go around that aisle at the bookstore to the manga section, and it just looks so pristine because everything is the same size. Everything has a similar, I mean... A lot of them have that predominantly white with the text trade dress on the spine and stuff. It looks so orderly that it is just a night and day difference. And frankly, I think that plays into sales. Oh. Obviously not pre-orders, but I know I've gone into certain comic stores over the years that nice, organized, easy to find things. And it's like, man, I can buy a lot at those stores. I go to other stores where it looks like it's the back stock room and not the front display area kind of a thing. There's stacks of stuff on the floor. There's only one or two stores I can think of that were that bad.
Yeah.
But it's disorganized. It's cluttered. It's not conducive to me saying, ooh, I want to buy things. And really, it's surprising how much a difference just a small amount of additional light can make in a store. Typically the ones I tend to like, I walk into and have an inherently good feeling in, are the brighter, well-lit stores. Because they also tend to, I don't know, sweep the floor and a few things like that, too.
General, upkeep.
Yeah. Let's see, we've got a couple of Rebirth things on the list. We've got, well, actually, we never got around to talking about the top item, did we?
Yes, which is actually an amazing, amazing comic.
I have not read this one, actually. It's 7 to Eternity, Volume 1 from Image Comics, topping the list at 8,911 units. Tell me about this book.
So it's by Rick Remender and Jerome Pena, and I can't remember who's coloring it, but it's kind of like a fantasy. It's kind of like a fantasy book with alternate realities and things like that. I don't want to spoil the plot, but it's very good. The art is so, so good. Jerome Pena is known, you know, as a fantastic artist, but he's also known to take his time. And so one of the things that Rick Remender did is just let, you know, because Rick Remender, he's one of those one of those writers who has a number of other successful books. So he doesn't need the income immediately from, you know, books to keep going. So he has money from all of his other projects that he's constantly doing at Image. And so he basically let Jerome Opeña draw this for like months and months and months to get ahead So he's just been spending as much time as he needs to on it. Now, that can be a downside if he ever gets to a point where he then falls behind. But for the first arc, it came out regularly and it's just gorgeous.
Well, and if he does kind of the saga approach of, okay, yep, let's go for a little hiatus and come back.
Mm-hmm.
If they can be enough ahead to know they're going to hit their deadlines, that's just a smart move.
Yeah.
Because, not continuity, but story momentum, I find makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
You know, if I get back to a book and it's like, when was the last time I read this? Where was it at again? And others, it's like, I know exactly where it left off. I want to follow up.
Yeah. And it's just the art is the huge standout here. I mean, obviously, like, the story is very good too, and they do a very good job in the first trade about kind of like setting up the characters, really doing a good job of character development. Because, you know, that's one of the things in the first trade is kind of, you know, you have so much work to do to set the setting and get everyone kind of on board in terms of a whole new world, especially when if this is successful, and I believe it is, they want to go on for quite a while. You know, that's always the hard balance in the Image world is getting enough people to stay with you enough and be interesting enough to kind of build that world so that you can have an ongoing series.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's very good. And obviously I'm glad to see that the sales have started off well. So
what's also kind of impressive is, the next item on the list, this happens to be reorder activity. But it was, Love is Love, a graphic novel from IDW. This is a book that was put together to honor those killed in Orlando. And all of the proceeds are going to the victims, the survivors, their families, and all of that stuff. So, you know, you've got Phil Jimenez, you've got a number of other people, contributing to this. And to see something that is a charity kind of, you know, thing, second item on the list, I think is awesome.
Yeah, no, definitely. And as you can see, the current item, number is almost as much as the last time. So it's like strong sales for sure.
Actually, the current sales were, 6,852, giving it a total.
Oh, that's right. You're right. So it's actually quite a bit more. So people kind of, I think, word of mouth, pushing it around, things like that.
Or it came out really late last month. I didn't get this chased down to the expected ship date or first ship date, so I'm not sure. But yeah, I mean, that's awesome that it did so well. It's nice to see companies like IDW, and certainly Marvel and DC have done this over the years with like 9/11 and things like that, having a sense of social consciousness and whatnot, giving creators an outlet to express their feelings on these things, giving readers a chance to kind of work through again traumatic events that have happened in society and stuff, and for it to go to a good cause and help those that were impacted by the events. That's great.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good when comics like that, you know, get wide release. I like that. So
I hope they don't need to happen too often.
Yes, you're right. Yeah, that's a good point.
But when they have to happen, I like to see them be successful at what they're trying to do. I mean, I've got both of the if there was the two collection 9/11 one, I think there was another one. I'm sure I've got all of those somewhere. Mm-hmm. And stuff. Rank number 3 is the first of the Rebirth ones. This is it's listed as Batman Detective Volume 1, which is interesting versus just Detective Comics. It did 5,920 units, and did not get confused with any previous volume of Detective or Batman, so I'm very happy about that. Jumping down to the other Rebirth ones, we've got Wonder Woman Volume 1, The Lies, at rank number 5, having done 5,252 units. That's just ironic, 5,252 for DC book. We've got Superman Action, Path of Doom trade paperback at rank number 7 of 4,102 units. Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, Volume 1, Sinestro's Law, at rank number 8, 3,743 units. And then we go down a ways and start hitting some, reorder activity. Down at rank 25, we talked about Batman Volume 1, I Am Gotham. It did another, 2,017 units. Down at rank 53, we have Flash Volume 1, 1,497 units of reorder activity. Rank number 55, Superman Volume 1, Son of Superman, 1,441 units of reorder activity. Even further down, rank 94, we've got Justice League Volume 1, The Extinction Machine, 1,025 units of reorder activity. And 107, we've got the Green Arrow, Volume 1, 925 units. Rank 115, we've got Nightwing, another 898 units. Aquaman down at rank 139 did 743 units. Green Lanterns Volume 1 down at rank 48, 691 units. And I don't think there are any further below that, but that's the ones I highlighted at least. So quite a bit of reorder activity on the ones we saw last month. The ones we see this month are doing pretty well. This seems like a good sign of acceptance and success or whatever for Rebirth. I think by and large it was a good move for DC. It seems to be working out for them by and large. The other one that's interesting is at rank 15, we've got Future Quest Volume 1 at a hair under 2,500 with 2,499 units. Have you been reading that?
No, I have not.
Did you grow up on Saturday morning Hanna-Barbera cartoons?
You know, I definitely watched them. I just, you know, they're just kind of one of the dozens of cartoons that I watched as a kid, though.
Okay, so not a hardcore fan of...
Yeah.
Okay. It's got the Impossibles, it's got Space's Ghost, it's got Johnny Quest, it's got the Herculoids, you know, Birdman. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I do remember Johnny Quest. I do remember liking that when I was a kid.
There was a stretch of those early on, like in the late 60s or whatever, but then he came back in the mid 80s or whatever.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's an age group thing. Because I was kind of, you know, watching the cartoons more in the 70s before he came back, I think, and that one may have been more in the 80s when he came back or something.
I was born in 81, so it was probably mid-80s that I was watching it.
All right. I think if you were a decade older, Future Quest would be right up your alley.
Okay.
And even though you're not, you may want to check it out. It's a lot of fun. I'm glad to see it seems to be doing well. I don't know what kind of lifespan these Hanna-Barbera titles have. I was just hearing that, like, Flintstones is going to end at number 12, I think.
Oh, is that so?
And it's an awesome book.
Yeah, that's a great book.
That was the one I was most skeptical about going in, to be honest. But it's really mastered the done-in-one story. It's got a sense of social commentary that I'm really enjoying. It's just a fun book. What else do we got on here that looks interesting? Anything kind of jump out at you this month as a must-talk-about item?
Well, you know, I just think that it's good to see the reorder activity for the new DC stuff because that you know, it's always with how New 52 started off well and then kind of petered out, you always worry about how many times can they go back to the well and will it be kind of diminishing returns and some of the things you see with Marvel happening, but... You know, it's good to see that they're still pretty strong, and obviously it's still early, but, you know, that's the kind of thing. I did want to highlight that as consistent with how I've seen Civil War II received in the community, the collected edition did not do as well, at least the hardcover version, so.
Yeah, for a Marvel event hardcover to do, what did it do, 2086?
Yeah. But usually, the month those come out, they're usually in the top five. This is barely, you know, in the top 10. And I just, you know, I heard nothing but negative things about Civil War II. So.
But hey, it beat out Scooby Apocalypse Volume 1 trade paperback by an entire 34 units.
And I'm sure all the people that paid $4.99 an issue will be very glad to hear that.
Yeah. Sometimes what beats what is just hilarious to me. You know, and again, particularly on the trade side, with price points that can be from like under $10 to, you know, $125 or more sometimes, there's just a huge range to be had. And certainly I think that's a deciding factor in many cases. As well it should be. I think people should do more at the, spend more at the $9.99 level than the $125 level. Cause that's a chunk of change. Going back to how old some of the material is, I do want to point out that at rank 47 was New Teen Titans Volume 6 trade paperback, covering New Teen Titans 35 to 41 and Batman and the Outsiders 5. That would have been, I think, just after the Judas Contract storyline. It's got Thunder and Lightning, it's got Hive, it's... I think also got the story of Dick Grayson learning the truth of Donna Troy's backstory. One of the many times the truth was revealed. Never twice was it the same truth. That goes back to the whole continuity thing. again, we've got a lot of big ticket items this time around. If we filter the list to that end of the spectrum of, I'm going to say anything $75 or over, we've got, 3 dozen items on the list. A lot of these are like the Daredevil Omnibus that was the top grossing item. It did, 1,921 units. We've got a couple of, Star Wars, the Marvel Years Omnibus. The Hawkeye Omnibus you were talking about, jumping down a little further, the Winter Soldier, Return of the Winter Soldier, Captain America Omnibus. Man, we've got at least 3 of those Star Wars years on there. And they did a Marvel Firsts Omnibus for the 1990s. I don't think I even realized they had done that. I remember when the trades came out, and I thought that was kind of interesting, but these are a bunch of... they're not even all number ones. They've got, Web of Spider-Man 100, a few other odd things here and there, but I guess the debuts of a lot of characters from that era. Okay. Almost everything on this list of $75 and above is, Marvel Comics. The notable exceptions are the Wonder Woman by Azzarello Absolute, the Green Lantern and the Silver Age Omnibus from, both from DC, and then the Alex Toth, Bravo for Adventures Artist Edition, hardcover. Everything else is Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
Which definitely goes to why they had such a overwhelming amount of the dollars this time around. Because every one of their items is, well, there are a few at $99.99, but there's a ton at $125 or $100. And for things like the S.H.I.E.L.D. Complete Collection or some of these, I can totally see it. The Avengers by Busick and Perez, Omnibus Volume 2. I'm imagining is the first volume hidden here somewhere? I'm not seeing it. Yeah, it's down there below. Again, those, man, great stories, great art. I could totally see somebody, really enjoying those Omnibus. But at that kind of a page count, that's gotta take a while to read. But man, that first volume of that Avengers by Busick and Perez, again, $125. But it gives you, the Avengers, 1998 run, issues 1 through 23, the 0, the number 1 rough cut, an issue of, let's see, Iron Man number 7, Captain America number 8, Quicksilver number 10, Avengers Annuals for 98 and 99, and Avengers Forever 1 through 12. That's hard to go wrong with. You go back to that second year of their stuff, and you get Avengers 24 through 56, another number one, annuals for 2000, 2001, Thunderbolts, 42 to 44, some of the Maximum Security tie-ins, the miniseries, the Ultron Imperative. So for a mere $250, you could get a really large run of Busick Perez, Avengers stuff, which I think is just one of the better runs on the book. This is probably the most high-priced items we've had on the list in ages. I mean, typically we'll have a few things here and there, but not like 3 dozen items at this kind of a price point. It's staggering.
Yeah, that is a good point.
I don't know if that means they think that people's budgets have somehow rebounded and they could afford this. Certainly some of these, I think, are discounted or whatever, but you don't drop 3 dozen high-priced items out there if you're thinking people are looking for lower-priced items.
Yeah, maybe they're making room in their warehouse. I don't know.
Could be. I would hope that they've got an eye on how much is sitting in the, presumably, I guess, the Diamond warehouse, but whatever warehouse, whatever inventory they're sitting on. And periodically, it's like, hey, let's not let it stock up too big. I mean, you want to have, less so for Omnibus, on the trade side and the hardcover side, I think you want to have enough copies that if there is a demand for some more Wolverine stuff around the time Logan comes out or something like that, that you can fill that.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there are a number of dollar kind of reprints or whatever over on the comic side for Marvel for Wolverine this time around. But you also don't want to be sitting on any kind of major back stock of $100 plus items. That's expensive.
Well, and you know, we know that in the direct market, all the risk is shifted to the retailer. So as soon as Marvel sells this stuff, they don't have to ever worry about it again, you know?
But that's my point, is apparently it's not all shifted to the retailers, because we've seen a few cases where clearly Marvel had a print run and they sat on the majority of it for some period of time.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that's more of an outlier where they made a mistake in estimating the demand? Or, you know, like for the Rawhide Kid one, you know?
Yeah, I certainly hope that's an outlier, because you can't run a business if that's a common thing. I don't know, for Rawhide Kid, that I don't know what led them to go with that high of a print run.
Because that might, you know how at certain at a lot of direct market comic stores, they say when they're ordering, they just say, oh, the subscription plus one or whatever. That would be what I would print. I would print literally, you know, let's say we got 500 orders. I would print 600 orders to account for like damage. And then
if I were setting print runs, I would do, obviously the orders that come in are the predominant factor. How much I think I need for reorders, how much I think I need for damages, and then where is the next price cutoff?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, you have to look at the breakdown of the spreadsheet.
And factor in how much I think I'm going to be sitting on for how long, because like the Marvel First 1990s Omnibus, that came out in, August 2015. Those Avenger ones I was talking about where I need to refilter the list to go find those again. Jeez. How long? I mean, those have been, had to be around for a while. The second came out in November 2015, the first in March 2015. So conceivably, they were sitting on hundreds of copies of those for, in the case of the first one, 2 years. And at $125 a piece, having that in inventory for almost 24 months, that's tying up capital.
Mm-hmm.
But if it got them to the price point, or maybe there was a minimum number they had to print to even make it viable or whatever, I'm not saying it was a bad decision. It's just not an obvious decision.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to know how well the different publishers do managing their inventory, because that's not something we have visibility into. Really, Diamond would be the place that has that visibility. But that would be something, if I wanted to be able to assess kind of the competitive health of these companies, would certainly be a factor.
Yeah. And
I think it's one that's harder for Marvel and DC to do well on because of the width of their library. They just have so many different things that at any point in time there could conceivably be an upsurge in interest for, that keeping all of it in print and whatnot is tough.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, there's the case of, what was it, the third volume of Starman was out of print or whatever, and it's like,
yeah,
you know, you hit that and it's like, well, crap, I can't move forward, you know, but that's one title out of how many they need to keep in print.
Yeah. And the nice thing is that, you know, digital has enabled people. Now, you know, you bring up a perfect example, like the Starman one is one that's super annoying for me, because like when I start a series in hardcover or paperback, I like to finish it out in that.
Mm-hmm.
And while I can read the entire series on digital, which is fine for me, like in the end, just like the people who complain about the Superman's costume, I don't refuse to read the series because I can't get it in physical form. I will read it in the digital. But when I'm trying to collect something, it really does bother me when I have like two hardcovers and three paperbacks of the series.
Yeah, there's just a or they change the trade dress with a new print, yeah, or something like that. It's hard to have that uniformity of packaging.
Yeah. Well, and it's also tough, and I understand they're caught in a bad spot. So, like, you know, the first two or three, you know, all the hardcovers did relatively well in the Starman, or they did well enough to sell the whole series of six hardcovers. Then when they were going to print the paperbacks, they stopped it with the second one. They solicited the third, but never actually, you know, they resolicited again to see if they could get more demand, and then it didn't show up. So it's like, but by the time they had done that, the third hardcover had gone out of print. So now people really are stuck.
I think for some of that, there is, in my mind, there's an expectation of if they start something, they need to do it with the intent of following through on it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, I'm going to be very curious if and when we finally get that Vigilante Southland trade that collects the 6-issue miniseries they cut off 3 issues in.
Yeah.
You know, what price point is that going to be at? When's it solicited? You know, all of that kind of a thing. Because they started a miniseries and didn't follow through on it. When you start a collection, be it the Epic line, be it a collection of hardcovers or softcovers for a given title, I think people expect that within a reasonable time frame, they will be able to get all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if the delay is too long between them, they may as well not bother in some cases.
Yeah.
So it's, and I, you know, I get the business conditions change, things don't work as well as they did, money's tight, et cetera, but it's still frustrating from a reader perspective, and that's something that they gotta keep the goodwill of the readers.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't make sense to, annoy your consumer base if you can avoid that. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. That's really what it comes down to.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, if it's just another consequence of the way that the direct market is set up, and the way that comics has either designed its world, or the past has created a funnel to where this is where we are. You know what I mean? So I understand that DC can't be constantly printing books if they're literally not making money on them. It's not an ongoing concern thing. So I get that, but it's just frustrating as a fan. And you're right. After a certain number of if you get burned a number of times, you basically don't trust them anymore. And so you are working with a finite amount of level of trust. And obviously, you know, the major publishers usually come through. You know, it's pretty rare for something like the Starman situation to happen. But when it does happen, it just, especially for a series that you really like I really like the Starman series. It just really sticks in my craw, as an old saying goes.
Well, and it can literally take decades to resolve the issue.
Yeah.
I've got that Nicolai Dante collection of trades I'm still missing a few on. And I'm waiting for 2008 to get around to those couple of trades. They're, you know, a couple in, so it may be, you know, another decade before they get there. And they're a smaller publisher compared to DC, so they're going to print tighter and it may be harder to get.
Mm-hmm.
So if I don't catch the solicit if and when it happens.
But the main question, John, will you have space in your house to put it by the time it gets there?
In 10 years, probably not. I'm already filling up. I need to do something about that.
Yeah, you need to add another level to your house, or dig a subterranean series of basements.
I need to discover that bat cave hidden under the house. That's it. That's exactly what I need.
Yeah, don't we all? Don't we all need more space for free, right?
Yeah. If we look at the price points, we had 37 items at $9.99, 45 at $14.99, 40 at $16.99, 32 at $19.99. Those are some of the more popular ones. Again, we go all the way up to one item at $150. If we look at the $100 and over section, that's only about 7% of the items on the list, but it accounts for about 28.47% of the retail dollars on the list.
That's pretty impressive.
If we extend that down to $75 or more, that's 44.34% of the list in terms of dollars at full cover price.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, the stores aren't paying that. The publishers aren't getting that. If you shop through either DCBS or have a retailer that gives you a discount for a pull and hold service or something like that, maybe you're not paying that much. I'm certainly not. I couldn't afford to. But it's staggering just how much of the list is there.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, at the under $20 range, that's another 34.48% of the retail dollars for the top 300 trades. So it's kind of disproportionate or whatever, oddly split in terms of price points this time around, very unusually so. But it's I'm sure it's an exciting time for the people who are wanting some of those omnibus and whatnot, and certainly there are a number of them I would say are well worth that money, even at that kind of a price point.
Yeah. And you know, I think Marvel has realized that there's just different segments of the market, and you know, so as long as they can make it work financially, that they are willing to put out more not saying something like Alpha Flight is obscure, but like it is a financial risk to put an omnibus like that out if you're not sure that there's demand. But I think that over the last few years, their previous sales of other omnibuy have proven to them that it's worth putting something out like that. So
yeah, absolutely. And for some of the older material that some of the newer readers may not be familiar with, there's some real gems out there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Alpha Flight by Byrne among them, the Avengers by Busiek Perez, absolutely. Or omnibusly maybe is the right term. But yeah, there's some great stuff to read. And if you can't afford those, check out Marvel Digital Comics online. Maybe they've got those issues there. You could use this as a reading list.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's a number of options to get the material without forking over the coffee table collapsing size editions. So anything else? Or does that pretty much do it?
I think that does it for this month.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If you differ from your reality, please verify that you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there is at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust it needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, the list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or excuse, N items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as I know now, has not been successfully done in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer is here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Math, logic, and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.